Full Story is supported by CommBank. CommBank is dedicated to using the latest tech to create real change. From utilizing agentic AI to outsmart cybercrime, to solving complex problems at scale, their teams support more than 17 million Australians every day. And you could be part of it. CommBank is looking for senior technologists to help influence strategy, security, and innovation across one of Australia's leading tech environments. If you're a curious mind who thrives on collaboration and is eager to engineer real impact, search CommBank Tech Careers.
This is The Guardian. I'm Joe Tovey, and this is the Full Story Newsroom Edition. Well, we are just one day away from the Farah by-election, a result which could mark a fundamental shift in Australian politics. So today, we're doing something a bit different. Our political editor, Tom McElroy, spoke with the independent candidate for Farah, Michelle Millthorpe, and we will be bringing you that interview shortly. Now, I should say up top here that we also invited the One Nation candidate, David Farley, to come on the podcast, but he declined the opportunity. Tom is actually with us now. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Joe. Great to be with you.
So I wanted to start by asking, this by-election could mark the first time a One Nation candidate is elected to the lower house. Just how significant would that be, and how do you think it'll play out?
Yeah, it's an amazing fact when you think about it. Pauline Hanson was originally a Liberal candidate, disendorsed from the party, but won in her own right back in 1996, and then moved to the Senate years later. Barnaby Joyce, the One Nation MP in the Parliament at the moment, was of course elected as a National and defected. So it would be something of a earthquake for One Nation to win a seat in the lower house in their own right. And it's significant also that a by-election that the whole country is looking at, I think perhaps for the first time, certainly the first time in many decades, doesn't involve one of the major parties in a kind of front-runner position. So it's quite significant. I think the challenge for the right side of politics, particularly the Liberal and National parties, is that One Nation is increasingly eating away at their vote. And this would be an example of them winning a seat from the Liberal Party. Of course, the by-election's been caused by Susan Lee, the former opposition leader's decision to retire from politics. So it could be something of an earthquake, I think.
And it could actually happen with Liberal national preferences, right? So they are directing their preferences to One Nation ahead of the independent. How consequential could that decision turn out to be?
I think it might be the factor that gets David Farley, the One Nation candidate, over the line. Going into the last few weeks of campaigning, there's been good momentum. Our colleague Sarah Basford-Canales has done some of this great reporting. Good momentum for both Millthorpe, the independent candidate, and Farley from One Nation. But the decision by the Liberals and Nationals to preference One Nation ahead of the independent could really sap her of some energy on voting day. I think if it's a tight result, that will be a consequential decision. And it's been something of a difficult one for Angus Taylor and for the Liberal Party, as well as for the Nationals. Back in the Howard era, there were long debates about how to deal with One Nation, whether to take them on directly, whether to try and marginalise them. And for a long time, the decision was to preference them as far down the ticket as possible to try and keep a fringe party on the fringes. But in more recent years, the Liberals have prioritised working with One Nation, sometimes making deals. This, I think, will be one of the major influences for David Farley. And I think if he gets elected, it'll be a question put to people like Angus Taylor. How important were the preferences? And are you rewarding the party that is really ebbing away your major support base in the regions?
Will that tie Angus Taylor in some ways to whatever One Nation ends up pushing for in the parliament, where things go for them now, I think is really interesting.
I completely agree. I mean, he has to walk a difficult line. He wants to win back One Nation voters, so he won't want to criticise the party too much. But equally, he needs them in the Liberal National column, not in the One Nation column.
There's already a bit of scepticism, isn't there, too, about whether David Farley would remain in One Nation, which has been interesting. I don't know how premature you think that is, but there does seem to be a bit of discontent there.
Yeah, Pauline Hanson has a history of falling out with people in her party, particularly men. It must be said, over the years, there have been some real high-profile advisers and MPs who she's split with over time. David Farley's campaign has been dogged by reports that he'd previously flirted with standing as a Labor candidate, that he's had long ties to other parts of the political spectrum, and indeed that he's expressed support for Michelle Millthorpe when she ran at the 2025 federal election. They're in a little bit of damage control in the last day or so, being very careful in what media opportunities David Farley takes part in, and really focusing on pressing the flesh with voters instead of facilitating media requests. I think partly that's to try and limit the stories about some kind of chaotic campaigning in the last few days.
Let's just talk about Millthorpe for a second. She's often described as a teal by her political opponents and by the media. How fair or meaningful a moniker do you think that is in relation to her?
Yeah, it's a difficult one, the teal question. The teals in the federal parliament now, these community independents, mostly from metro seats, don't like the teal moniker either and often tell journalists not to use it. I think Michelle Millthorpe is closer to someone like Helen Haynes, the Indi independent MP in a neighbouring seat. She has that voices of backing, that group that has sprung up in local communities around the country and put forward independent candidates. But it must be said that some of the money that she has fundraised during this campaign has come from Simon Holmes-A-Court's Climate 200 movement. So that is similar to the teal MPs already elected to Parliament. We talked to her in the interview about why she doesn't like this moniker and why she doesn't believe that it matches her political identity. I don't think the teal moniker will go away quickly if she wins, and I think it'll continue to be a challenge for the press gallery and for political watchers to understand exactly where she fits on the spectrum.
Okay, here is Michelle Millthorpe.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for making time in the last week of the by-election campaign. You must be running all over the electorate, so we really appreciate it.
No worries.
This is the second time you've campaigned for the seat of Farah. You ran at the federal election last year and fell just shy of the then Deputy Liberal leader, Susan Lee, now the former member, I think something like 6%. Now your main opponent is the One Nation candidate, David Farley. Tell me why independent candidates are resonating in Farah, why you're among the front runners in this by-election.
Look, I think, you know, last time we saw that there was a real shift. You know, we had a swing away from the coalition who had been, you know, here for the whole of our history of Farah, in every booth except for two. And, you know, I won Albury as well. It's sort of showing that people are looking for change. And, you know, I think it's shown that regional people are probably tired of just going with the status quo and trying to elect a major party who's sort of forgotten about us. And that's, you know, why I ran in the first place. I think that was the message that was resonating last time. And now that you've got both One Nation and myself allegedly as the, you know, the front runners, it's, you know, just shows that we're looking for change here.
I can't remember another by-election where one of the major party candidates hasn't been in the box seat, you know, at least in the front, among the front runners. Tell me what you think that tells us and why One Nation's surge is working for them in Farah this time.
Look, you know, they really weren't present at all last time. One Nation, we didn't see them across the electorate hardly at all in terms of campaigning. I think they've really jumped onto that idea that people are fed up and not feeling like they're being represented. And, you know, there's a lot of frustration and anger with some people in the community because they are experiencing, you know, cost of living crisis. We've got successive governments who have done little along water and water policy, and you know our healthcare outcomes are pretty poor out here in regional and rural areas. So I think it's just playing into that. People are feeling tired and frustrated and they're looking for change.
Do you think those problems that you identify, the frustration and anger, dissatisfaction with the system, is different between the cities and the countries? Is there something specific about outside metropolitan Australia like the electorate of Farrer?
Look, I think, you know, if we're looking at our regional communities here across Farrer, particularly the irrigation communities and water communities, bad policy has really hurt the people that live out there. And, you know, we talk about our producers and things like that being unable to provide food for the country. And the reality is that when our producers aren't doing well, our towns, our regional communities don't do well either. So we've seen, you know, as I said, their services being taken from communities. There's, you know, young families are leaving because there's no jobs and no work. There's generational farmers selling up. So there is a real distrust of the government because people look at this and say, well, it's government policy that's led to these things that are bleeding our communities dry. And, you know, I think that that's where a lot of the frustration comes from in some of those outer communities that depend on water particularly for their survival.
What do you think about the trend of the movement away from the major parties in general? About a third of voters at the last federal election didn't support one of the major parties, and the community independents, the Teals, are a new force in federal parliament. Do you see a fundamental shift underway? Is that part of the wave that might bring you to federal parliament?
Yeah, look, I do see that shift, and that's the reason I ran in the first place. Like, I'm traditionally, you know, National Party, Liberal Party voter. That's sort of how I was brought up, and, you know, I saw a National Party that were doing really well regionally when I was a young person. We had Kay Hull where I was from and, you know, Tim Fisher down here in Farrer before I came down here. So, yeah, that's where I came from. That was my base. And then I just... Yeah, you know, I look and see, you know, criticisms of independence and say, well, if you were doing your job better as parties, we wouldn't exist. Like, I wouldn't be running if I felt like I was being represented by the person who was meant to be, you know, my member. So there is dissatisfaction, and instead of this introspective look from the parties, you know, it's this constant blaming others for the position they're finding themselves in at the moment.
And I understand you don't like the Teal moniker. You don't like being described as a Teal. Just talk me through that, because it's something that the media does quite often to the community independent movement, Guardian included, I must admit.
Oh, look, no offence intended, but I think it's just a lazy rhetoric to try and bunch people together. And, you know, the idea of true independence is, you know, it's different and frightening for people. People don't particularly like change. I just push back on it because, you know, we see that, you know, the Teal independent is related to those inner city independents who, you know, are pro-climate change and pro-things that, and I'm not saying that I'm anti-climate change, but what I am saying is that my positions and policies are different to what they produce. So, you know, I see the real long-term impact of bad water policy on the communities that I want to represent. And, you know, they've voted for Restoring Our Rivers, you know, legislation and things that have actually damaged and hurt our communities. And I don't think it's because they wanted to do that, but they don't understand the actual impact that these policies have had, in our regions. And, you know, so there's those kinds of things that, you know, like even when we talk about fuel tax credits and things like that, I see why fuel tax credits are really important for, you know, our primary producers who are living on the land. Like they use fuel as a tool for their trade, and you know, to say that we're going to remove those does not work in this context. So, you know, as I said, it's a lazy way to lump people together, because I think people are still unsure about, you know, what is this movement? This is change, and I'm not sure if I like change. It's a normal response for people to feel a little bit uncertain of change. So, yeah.
All right. Well, let me ask the same question in a different way then, perhaps.
Yeah.
Who are you closer to on a spectrum? Someone like Angus Taylor or Matt Canavan, or someone like Zali Steggall, or another of the Teals, perhaps Monique Ryan?
Oh, you know, there was a time when I would say Matt Canavan, but he's been saying nasty things about me in the last few days, even though he's lovely to my face. You know, the idea of the National Party is one that, you know, they're meant to be representing regional Australia. In terms of putting thought in and representing communities, I see that, you know, I see Monique Ryan doing that well for her community. And Angus Taylor, I just don't think we've got a whole lot in common. And there is that issue around water that, you know, he still hasn't really addressed properly. But I don't really see myself as aligning with any of those people, to be completely honest, in terms of, you know, who I am. But I know that, you know, I sit beside and talk to people from around this electorate. You know, I've talked to, you know, mayors of communities and leaders in community, and, you know, I understand where they're coming from, and we can have good conversation about what it is that we need here. So that's the main thing that I need to do. And then I just need to be able to develop relationships with those people that you mentioned to make sure that they're hearing our needs as well.
And what about the scepticism that's sometimes attached to the community independents or the Teals, depending on what you want to call them, the underlying support that you get from Climate 200? Have people raised that with you? Is it something that draws a little bit of scepticism from some voters in Farrer?
Yeah, look, it is. It's raised pretty much every interview that I do. You know, and I'm really transparent about the fact that I have received Climate 200 money before. I mean, last election, I ran an extremely skinny election. You know, we compare it to, you know, the $1.3 million per electorate that you average out the Liberal Party spend last time. And I think it was over $1 million for Labor. I'm really serious about this campaign. I'm really serious about this is the most important election that we will have here in Farrer, and I cannot apologise for taking it seriously and receiving donations from people. And I have had a small donation from Climate 200. It doesn't come with strings attached, because I've had donations from, you know, thousands of people across Farrer and the country. I still get one every Friday from Wendy, $10 every Friday. I've got that for nearly 2 years, and, you know, it's my most consistent and important donation, because Wendy also then stands next to me at the polling booth and we talk to people.
A local community member, I take it.
Yeah, that's it. And, you know, that's what this is really about. You know, and again, there's no strings attached. I'm very transparent about that, and you know, it's nice that so many people think that I would make a good representative and prepared to put that money behind me. You know, I still argue that we don't have transparency from the major parties or any of the parties. It's not demanded of them in the same way it is of me, and I don't have a problem with that from my point of view. But I do have a problem with the hypocrisy with calling out, you know, my donations and then not scrutinising that of other people.
I'm the first to say that the reporting rules around political donations are pretty lax in Australia, and we don't get enough intel into exactly who's funding our politics.
No.
In that vein, you say Wendy's giving you $10 a week every Friday. Are you prepared to say how much Climate 200 is donating to your campaign?
Look, at this point, I'm just going to wait until the until we do all of the transparency, you know, accounting at the end. The reality for me is that, you know, I've had people who have been working really hard in the team on both, you know, getting donations and making all of that happen. And I've been working really hard at listening to the people and getting policy positions and things like that out there that are reflective of them. So it's not that I know that I've got $20,000. I helped kickstart my campaign, which was brilliant right at the start in February. And I've had some money from regional voices. You probably know more about that than I do, Tom. I think I haven't caught up with that, but, you know, look, I'm just really grateful that there's people that are doing that. And again, it's not about being secretive. It's just literally about, it's not my focus at the moment. So, and I do know that it will be, publicly available at some time. So, that's okay. And I'm just, again, grateful that people think enough of me that they will donate.
When you're out campaigning and you've been on the ground longer than anybody for this by-election, what is the mood like? What are some of the issues that people are describing to you? And has there been a change since the election a year or so ago back in 2025?
Look, there hasn't been much of a change. I think that's one of the issues, you know. We've got regional communities who, again, like we can talk about water until, you know, for hours, which is a massive issue. But, you know, one of the other things that's critically important is, you know, the lack of healthcare services in regional communities. And, it's not just about, you know, GPs and things like that too. It's about keeping, our state governments accountable and actually giving equitable funding to some of our regional hospitals. We've had, you know, Griffith Base Hospital has had a major update in, New South Wales there. And that it's not fully funded. They don't have, you know, the specialists that they need in that hospital. And then we have data that does not reflect reality happening all the time. So, yeah, there needs to be a greater level of accountability there. But we've got communities that don't have GP services. We've got communities that are, you know, paying, you know, for GPs to be there, you know, with clinics because, you know, they haven't got any government funding to help with that, paying for aged care facilities because there's no government funding. We've got communities without childcare. These are things that are happening consistently. And here in Albury, you know, we're trying to look at get a new hospital and a new site here. And we've been offered a second rate or probably 22nd rate refurb of a hospital. You know, we had 91 beds short at the start of the day yesterday. Like, these are things that are happening to us and not with us. And it's just, we're not being heard. So we've been a really safe seat for a really long time. And hopefully with this election, we see some change and people starting to look at us and really put the investment into these communities that we need.
What about the cost of living issue? Has that been a main concern people have spoken to you about?
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, with the last, you know, 6 or so weeks with the Middle East conflict, fuel has certainly been a major issue for many of our communities. And, you know, actually not being able to access fuel has been huge, not just the cost. We've got farmers who've considered not planting crops this year because they didn't have water, then they didn't have fuel, then they might not have fertilizer. So it's that real triple threat there. And again, as I said sort of earlier, if we have our farming communities not being able to produce, the flow and effects of that in other, you know, the rest of the town is really felt. You know, you don't buy your new shoes, you don't get your new car, you don't get your tractor serviced, you know, those things that help keep communities going, you know, stop. So there's certainly been, that's been a major cost of living issue. And again, you know, the energy cost of energy and everything is huge as well. And we're just not seeing those prices coming down, even though many of our communities are hosting large scale renewable projects. So, you know, these are things that are really frustrating people out there.
You've mentioned water policy a few times. Tell us your position on buybacks, because I know it's an important issue in your part of the world, and also whether you support net zero by 2050 policies.
Yeah, so with water buybacks, I'm saying let's stop the water buybacks. You know, at the moment we've got the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder it currently holds 72% of the water in the system, which leaves only 28% for the consumptive pool, which means the water that is actually being used by community and by producers. So there's a lot of, that's $11 billion worth of water that the Commonwealth actually holds. Now, we've got the Murray-Darling Basin Review happening right now. And in that review, you know, people are putting submissions in. At the beginning, they weren't going to consider the socioeconomic impact of water buybacks on communities. And fortunately, they've changed the scope of that, which means that is being considered. But those submissions are going to show, you know, that this has been a plan that most people would agree that the Murray-Darling Basin plan needed to exist. But it's been a failed plan that's had unintended consequences. And one of the things that's been the major issue is that wedge between environment and humans and environment and farmers. And we want to see a more integrated approach moving forward. You know, this is what the community keeps telling me, that they want to be part of the conversation. I'm calling for a royal commission into the Murray-Darling Basin plan and water policy. And with that, you know, we want to compel evidence. We want to see that, and we want the terms of reference to be guided by the people that have been most impacted there. Everybody that you talk to, acknowledges that it's so important that we look after the environment, we look after the quality of water in our river. But what they're saying is we need to stop wedging the environment and human use into the future. There needs to be a more integrated approach. The other thing, yes, so stopping water buybacks and, you know, this transparency and accountability over who owns water. But a lot of foreign ownership of water in our country. But Canadian super funds, you know, who are holding a lot of water. And, you know, how do we get that back? You know, it's like the toothpaste is out of the tube and we don't know how to put it back in. So, they're the things that I'd like to see more accountability over, and certainly support our communities in saying no more water buybacks. We need to revise the plan and put those two things together moving forward.
And net zero by 2050?
Net zero, but look, I would love to see us get to net zero by 2050. I am also seeing communities where there's been this massive rollout and very little change to energy prices. And what we need to do is see those costs of energy come down, quickly, but not at the expense of, these communities. And, we've got one of our renewable energy zones in the Murrumbidgee local government area they've got three projects in that zone, and they're seeing very little remuneration or put back into their community there. I think that we need to make sure we're rolling this plan out with really good consultation, a framework for these communities where they're seeing remuneration and benefits in there. Like, they are shouldering the burden of a large rollout for the whole country, and their contribution has not been really valued at all. And it's caused a lot of disconnect between community, and it's caused a lot of aggro between regional people and the city, you know, whether it's deliberate or not. So, you know, we need to make sure that if we're going to reach net zero, that we're doing it in a really well thought out planned way, and not just imposing these projects on communities in the way that we have, with very little consultation and remuneration.
Let me ask you again about David Farley, your main opponent. He's had a difficult couple of weeks after it emerged that he sought to run for Labor previously, and indeed that he endorsed you last year as the independent candidate. What do you make of this? Is he a risky choice for the electorate?
Look, I just want to be a representative of this electorate, and I've chosen to do that as an independent. I've been really consistent in that. I think he did endorse me. He said I was a straight shooter and a good woman, and I'll take that. That hasn't changed since last year.
How consequential do you think the decision by the coalition parties to preference him over you will be on Saturday?
Well, the coalition are fighting for their relevance at the moment. So I think that they have been strategic in doing that. I think they think that if he gets in, we're already seeing evidence that the egos within the One Nation Party are going to probably be fighting against one another. We've seen, that David's been in trouble with Pauline and Barnaby over the last few days, and, you know, how long is that going to last? And we know 75% of One Nation members don't stay One Nation for long. Look, I think it was a strategic move by the coalition to preference him first before me. It's disappointing but not surprising, because I think they recognise that, my intentions are to represent really well here, and that if I got in, I'd probably do a really good job, and that's threatening to them. I would encourage them to maybe do a little bit of deep diving into why it is people don't want to vote for them anymore, instead of being like this.